This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. Saudi Aramco started its initial public offering on Sunday, 7 weeks after crippling attacks on its oil facilities. Reuters' David Doyle reports.
Saudi Arabia kickstarted an initial public offering of the world's largest oil company on Sunday, 3 years after a listing of Saudi Aramco was first flagged, and just 7 weeks after crippling attacks on its oil facilities. The IPO will be split into two tranches, one each for institutional and individual investors. Sources say Aramco could offer 1 to 2% of its shares, raising as much as $20 billion to $40 billion. The company is valued by bankers and company insiders at around $1.5 trillion, 50% more than the world's most valuable listed companies, Microsoft and Apple.
Tens of thousands of Islamists at a protest camp in Pakistan's capital are awaiting a deadline set by their leader calling for the prime minister to resign. Cleric Maulana Fazlur Rahman led a caravan of supporters to Islamabad last week in a bid to pressure Imran Khan to step down, calling him an illegitimate ruler. Rahman has hinted he could direct his partisans to march on the seat of Pakistan's government and force Khan's resignation. Khan says he has no plans of quitting. Anti-government protesters in Iraq's capital have shut down key roads. Schools and government offices are also closed in Baghdad and other Iraqi cities Sunday, the start of the work week in the Muslim-majority country. The demonstrators are demanding change in the country's political system. Southeast Asian leaders agreed Sunday to work with China and other neighbors to transcend conflicts over trade policies and territorial disputes for the sake of stronger economies and regional stability. For more news, please visit us at voanews.com. This is VOA News. A French minister says the new Brexit date of January 31st is not negotiable and the risk of a no-deal Brexit remains. AP's Zaria Shackley reports.
Minister for European Affairs Amélie de Montchalin told Europe One Radio that she's advising French companies to continue preparing for a scenario in which Britain leaves the bloc on January the 31st without a divorce deal, despite getting a three-month Brexit extension from the European Union. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson had promised to take Britain out of the EU by October 31st, with or without a deal, but the British Parliament blocked his plans. Now Britain is holding an election on the 12th of December, and Johnson hopes to get a more Brexit-friendly parliament. I'm Zaria Shakili.
Riot police stormed several malls in Hong Kong on Sunday to stop pro-democracy protests. However, violence did break out when a knife-wielding man slashed several people and bit off part of the ear of a local pro-democracy politician. Media reports say five people were injured, including two in critical condition. The White House is defending President Donald Trump's bid to get Ukraine to investigate one of his chief 2020 Democratic political rivals, former Vice President Joe Biden, saying the request did not amount to an impeachable offense. One of Trump's top aides, Kellyanne Conway, told CNN the president has done nothing to warrant impeachment. Meanwhile, on ABC's This Week, Republican Congressman Steve Scalise says House Democrats are intent on ousting President Trump.
They didn't negotiate with the White House on that resolution. Under Clinton and Nixon, there was a bipartisan negotiation to at least have fair rules. They don't want fair rules. They just want to hurt President Trump's chances to win re-election.
Democrat Elliot Engel defending the process, saying the Republicans are President Trump. Saying the Republicans and President Trump have the same rights as those in two previous presidential impeachments.
They have the same due process rights that we've had in the Nixon and the Clinton impeachments. You know, they can. We took depositions for several weeks. They complained about that. This week, we're releasing the transcripts of all the depositions, and everything else is going to be public.
If the full House on a simple majority vote approves articles of impeachment against Mr. Trump in the coming weeks, a trial would be held in the Republican-majority Senate, where a two-thirds vote would be needed to convict and remove him from office. A federal judge has blocked a Trump administration rule requiring immigrants prove they will have health insurance or can pay for medical care before they can get visas. Seven U.S. citizens and a nonprofit organization filed the federal lawsuit Wednesday, contending the rule would block nearly two-thirds of all prospective legal immigrants. For more news whenever you want it, download the VOA mobile app. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the U.S. House of Representatives votes to approve rules for the impeachment inquiry into President Donald J. Trump as it heads into a more public phase. At the heart of this inquiry, which officially began on September 24, when House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced it, is a July 25th phone call between U.S. President Donald Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. The phone call was so alarming to many senior career national security officials familiar with the contents that it prompted a whistleblower complaint. This complaint, the substance of which several current and former senior U.S. officials corroborated in testimonies to House impeachment investigators, reveals a pressure campaign by President Trump toward Kiev. Mr. Trump allegedly sought to withhold almost $400 million in critical military assistance to Ukraine, which is under siege by Russia, until Ukraine's leader Zelensky promised to conduct investigations into Trump's 2020 main political rival, former Vice President Joe Biden, as well as his son Hunter, and to state so publicly. Federal law expressly states that it is illegal for a person to solicit, accept, or receive anything of value from a foreign national in connection with U.S. elections. The White House released a rough transcript of the phone call, although important references are missing, according to a key witness, which President Trump said was, quote, perfect and totally appropriate. But the fact that White House officials ordered information about President Trump's phone call with President Zelensky be removed from a classified server that typically stores such records to a hyper-secure server normally reserved for material of the gravest sensitivity, which this was not, calls into question Trump's innocuous characterization. His acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, blurted out in a recent White House press briefing that the call did involve a so-called quid pro quo, U.S. military aid in exchange for the political investigations, and told the press to, quote, get over it. However, recent closed-door testimonies, which may likely become public in light of the vote to open up impeachment proceedings, of current U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Bill Taylor and former Senior Director for European and Russian Affairs on the National Security Council, or NSC, Fiona Hill, raised alarms on two fronts. These officials were concerned about conditioning U.S. aid to Ukraine on Kiev's willingness to help President Trump with a political favor. They were also disturbed by an unofficial diplomatic track, a shadow foreign policy, if you will, being run by Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, involving individuals who do not normally cover Ukraine policy, such as Energy Secretary Rick Perry and U.S. Ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland. This unofficial diplomatic track succeeded in ousting longstanding career diplomat Maria Yovanovitch, U.S. ambassador to Ukraine until May 2019, when President Trump abruptly recalled her from her post following claims by Trump's surrogates that she was undermining Trump's efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate his political rival, former Vice President Joe Biden. Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman, the top Ukraine official on the NSC and the only witness so far who actually listened to the July 25th phone call between Trump and Zelensky firsthand, told investigators that what he heard on the phone call was, quote, inappropriate and would undermine U.S. national security, unquote. Despite his impeccable credentials as a scholar, Iraq War veteran, and Purple Heart recipient, President Trump disparaged him as a, quote, never-Trumper. However, Colonel Vindman refuted this false characterization by conveying through his patriotic and dignified demeanor and his testimony that by reporting his concerns to the NSC legal counsel, he was, quote, acting out of a sense of duty. He said, quote, I am a patriot, and it is my sacred honor to advance and defend our country, irrespective of party or politics, unquote. Well, joining us to discuss the nexus between the impeachment inquiry, Ukraine, and U.S. national security are P.J. Crowley, he's former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, and former colonel in the U.S. Air Force, who has served in numerous other senior national security positions, and Mark Simakovsky, he's a senior fellow in the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council, that's a policy group based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
So, PJ, let me begin with you. I'd like to get your take quickly on this public phase of the impeachment inquiry. Now we have a vote, primarily along party lines. Now we're going to open the proceedings to the public. Mr. Trump never denied he made that infamous phone call on July 25th, the rough transcript of which we have. Nonetheless, you know, he has been, and the White House have been stonewalling, have disparaged the whole impeachment inquiry. How do you see this vote and its significance?
It is significant, and I think it is vitally important that the proceedings move from the evidence collection stage, if you will, to a public phase where the American people and others can begin to understand the context of what the House of Representatives is investigating. I served on the National Security Council staff during the impeachment of Bill Clinton. And I think, fortunately for Bill Clinton, it was a world without Twitter. And so despite his domestic political challenges at home, Clinton used foreign policy, the challenges in Bosnia, Kosovo, Iraq, pursuing peace in Northern Ireland and the Middle East. He was able to use foreign policy to convey to the American people that notwithstanding impeachment, I'm continuing to do my job. I think, unfortunately for President Trump, in this age of Twitter and cable news, you're beginning to see a White House that is obsessed with the impeachment inquiry. But this will all play out in front of the American people.
Well, Mark Tsimikoski, the White House may be obsessed with the impeachment inquiry, but some would argue that if the White House had not stonewalled on simple requests for documents and witnesses in the aftermath of the Robert Mueller probe into Russia's interference in the 2016 elections and not characterized this impeachment inquiry or the fact that the Congress has the absolute duty to conduct oversight, that perhaps we wouldn't be where we are today. The Congress is a co-equal branch of government, and one of their duties is to conduct oversight. So quickly, your take on the significance of this vote.
You know, this vote is clearly significant in that it brings the investigation into the public realm, which the Speaker has been pressured to do. Of course, the Speaker has been resistant into conducting impeachment hearings until this Ukraine crisis, in a way, fell into the House's lap. This was not something that was neither asked for nor generated by anyone other than the President of the United States. So in many ways, there was, I believe, a requirement to move forward. And as more witnesses have been called and as more information has come to light corroborating how this Ukraine investigation and the president's actions were detrimental to U.S. national security, and potentially people around the president have also lied about the role that the president has played and the rationale for the decision, I think has only fueled the need for continuing to conduct this investigation and conduct it in a way that will provide the American people the ability to have full transparency into the investigation. So I do think it's critical, but I also think that there's going to continue to be new areas of information that are going to surprise many people and potentially new witnesses that will likely continue to accelerate the reality that the House will most likely impeach the president this year.
Turning back to you, PJ Crowley, let's go back to that fateful phone call on July 25th. As you said, you served on the National Security Council. You have been a public official. You are a retired military officer. How do you see this phone call that still President Trump says was perfect? He doesn't see any problem with the quid pro quo. And the fact that this call was then placed on a super secure server, career officials were sidelined. I mean, how does it strike you?
What I blink about, and I blink a lot when I observe what's happening at the White House these days, is a foreign policy that is unmoored, if you will, from a thoughtful national security process. You know, under Republican and Democratic administrations, going back to the first Bush administration, the National Security Advisor, Brent Scowcroft, invented what is called the principles process. You start with, you know, policy coordinating committees, work up to so-called deputies of national security agencies, up to the principals who lead those agencies, the Secretary of Defense, State, and so on. And their job is to formulate foreign policy. They make decisions where they can in the national interest. And in those tough calls, they tee up options for the president. You know, this is a White House that doesn't have a strong, effective national security process. And so this is where, as Bill Taylor described in his testimony, you've got an official policy and an official channel and an irregular channel that seems to be taking actions that are contrary to that policy and that national interest. When I was at the White House, I would routinely listen to presidential phone calls. Vladimir Putin as a brand new, president of the Russian Federation, other leaders. And what was important there was that when the president talked to a president or a prime minister or a king, it was important for the so-called interagency to understand what they talked about, what they committed to do together. That's the purpose for a record. This White House has decided to restrict information on who the president talks to, what they talk about, and this is an extreme case of that. And that means you've got a foreign policy that is less informed, more impulsive, not necessarily guided by longstanding bipartisan national interests.
Turning to you, Mark, for your take on this phone call, particularly from the Ukrainian perspective. You have a new president, Zelensky. He was elected to continue to rid the country of corruption. And now we have what some experts say, by virtue of the phone call, something that sounded like an old-fashioned type of shakedown. I'll give you this aid, which was deliberately placed on hold by the president. We have many witnesses who said that. It was placed on hold, which in and of itself is suspicious. And then he says, I'd like you to do a favor, though. In other words, he asks, that is, Zelensky would like to know when the missiles are coming, and then president. So how do you see Zelensky's position? Talk about his vulnerability as someone, a newly elected president, not wanting to be on the wrong side of their benefactor. How are they reacting?
So from Ukraine's perspective, they're at a very vulnerable time in their modern history. They're occupied by the Russian Federation. There's a new Ukrainian president that has committed to his population that he's going to pursue corruption and advance Ukraine's fight against corruption, while also in parallel trying to make a path towards peace with the Russian Federation. So usually when Ukraine conducts such a difficult environment, it needs its partners at its side. And the United States, for the last 20 years, has been by Ukraine's side on a bipartisan basis. So the credibility and the consistency that Ukraine usually expects from the United States is lacking from this administration because President Trump, frankly speaking, had no interest in battling corruption anywhere in the world. There is no pillar of U.S. policy in the Trump administration that has focused on corruption being a major issue that the White House has cared about. All of a sudden, the president makes a contingent that for Ukraine to have the United States as a partner, it needs to not only battle corruption, but battle it against the president's potential political enemies. And so I think the Ukrainians' perspective is they are questioning the credibility of the United States in actually being interested in corruption, which will thereby undermine Ukraine's willingness to fight corruption if it thinks that its partner is really not very interested in corruption at all, but just interested in using an investigation to undermine the president's enemies. I think one thing that PJ said, though, is critical, and also how Ukraine is able to navigate this in terms of consistency, is an unmooring of process. There also has been an unmooring of the national interest here in the United States. The president is pursuing a policy that is simply serving his own personal interests, and that policy is divorced from the normal policy process that brings together ideas about how the United States should deal with a certain country, and also the security assistance package that the White House and the Pentagon developed together was done months before this decision. And so from the Ukrainians' perspective, they're confused, they're feeling increasingly isolated, and again, they will be increasingly able to be influenced by Russia's pressure campaign when they see themselves essentially divorced from a U.S. partner that has been critical in providing Ukraine the kind of support that it needs to keep its independence.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Our guests are P.J. Crowley, former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, and he also served on the National Security Council. And Mark Simakovsky, from whom you just heard. He's Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. We're discussing the impeachment inquiry into President Trump's alleged abuse of power as it relates to U.S. ally Ukraine and national security. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to Olubisi Adeola from Wari, Nigeria. Now, if you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter at voanews.com, or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, P.J. Crowley, to talk about the fact that the foreign policy has become, as you said, unmoored from a thoughtful U.S. process. We have now what is considered a sort of a shadow foreign policy, a parallel track run by Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, involving the U.S. ambassador to the EU, who also presented testimony. Some people think he may have presented some false testimony. What is your take on this and the sidelining of career officials knowledgeable about the region and about the credibility of our foreign policy and the importance of national security, Marie Yovanovitch? I'd like to get your take on that and the fact that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo appears to be sort of abandoning these career officials. He allowed Yovanovitch to be recalled to empower this non-official track, which has a political agenda.
I think it's important to understand, by my count, we've had 15 high-level officials involved so far in testimony, you know, 14 within the context of the impeachment inquiry, you know, one John Sullivan, the Deputy Secretary of State, who's being nominated to be the U.S. ambassador to Russia. Obviously, he appeared in a public testimony. But for the most part, these are career officials. They've served both Democratic presidents and Republican presidents. They are steeped in and supportive of a long-term bipartisan policy with regard to Ukraine. Then they see these valid U.S. national interests being undermined, you know, by the irregular or informal channel apparently led by Rudy Giuliani. But I think to build up for a moment on what Mark just said, one piece of the favor that President Trump asked of President Zelensky, you know, was an investigation of the Bidens. The other piece was to go back and try to revisit history, you know, right, with respect to CrowdStrike and alleged Ukrainian influence in the 2016 election. And I think this again brings back into sharp relief the blind spot that President Trump has had throughout his presidency about Russia. You know, in the abstract, sure, we want a constructive relationship with Russia, but he has ignored history of the last 20 years with Vladimir Putin as president of Russia, to where the areas of common interest between the United States and Russia are shrinking, the areas of conflict are expanding. And here, you know, in Helsinki, where he said, I see as an equivalence what the U.S. intelligence community said, that Russia attacked the United States, and President Putin, who said, we didn't do it. You know,
He sided with Putin.
He did. And so he has latched on to this very strange conspiracy theory that wasn't Russia, it wasn't Ukraine. And as both Bill Taylor and Marie Yovanovitch said, the only person who benefits from this entire process is Vladimir Putin. Last time I checked, if Putin's happy, this is not good for the United States.
Absolutely. But there's a pattern here, isn't there, Mark Simakovsky? You were at these microphones right after the Mueller probe ended. And it's clear, it's unequivocal, that Russia interfered in the U.S. election and did so in a sweeping and systematic fashion. And then there's other elements that maybe don't rise to a criminal conspiracy, but so many interactions between the Trump campaign and Russian officials and the disinformation campaign that the Russians engaged in to sow chaos, sow discord among the American electorate. So speaking of which, we now have, as PJ mentioned, the request for Ukraine, in addition to investigating Biden, that's a political opponent, and that right there is a red flag, to investigate conspiracy theories that have already been debunked, that somehow it wasn't Russia, after all the Mueller investigation showed it was Russia. I mean, why this insistence? And then we have the Justice Department turning the probe into the origins of the Russia investigation into a criminal inquiry. It seems very odd to the person who's reading and trying to get a handle on what is really going on in this administration. Why are they latching on to these conspiracy theories?
You know, I think you made the exact right connection of where this was generated. And it was generated as a result from the president and the president's team's perspective of a successful conclusion of the Mueller investigation. So the president's attorney, Mr. Giuliani, essentially went from the defensive to defend the president surrounding the Mueller investigation, which from the president's perspective was concluded successfully, to the offensive. And the offensive element of this strategy was to go out into the world and find countries and or pieces of information that would help and facilitate the president's election in 2020. The primary target of that offensive campaign was Ukraine, because Ukraine, the president believed, had information that could benefit his campaign. And that, of course, is as a result of the former vice president's son being on a board of Burisma, an energy company that faced multiple rounds of investigation. Even though the president's son, there was never and has never been any evidence of any wrongdoing. There was never anything illegal about it. But the main issue is Giuliani found what he perceived as a vulnerable candidate to pressure. And the United States had tools to pressure Ukraine, primarily through an assistance package that everyone in the U.S. government had supported. And of course, what you started to see were casualties along that pressure. So a U.S. ambassador that wasn't agreeing with Giuliani. I think the main issue, though, is because the president has these associates that are looking for political dirt, essentially interfering in U.S. foreign policy, that's where this administration got themselves in trouble, because there's a whole cohort of professionals managing U.S. policy toward Ukraine that started to see an invasion of this professional foreign policy discourse by those that are essentially political operatives. And those operatives, you're also seeing some of them arrested in Florida because they clearly were seeking to get dirt on Vice President Biden while also engaging in their own nefarious personal financial connections.
And of course, you're referring to Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, I believe.
That's correct.
Both Ukrainian-born with very shady backgrounds. And they were illegally funneling money to pro-Trump election committee and other Republican politicians. And they were arrested in Dulles Airport.
That's correct. And there's a quid pro quo there as well, where you have, almost in desperation, Giuliani trying to find fixers that would help facilitate his investigation. He was essentially stopped at the door of the U.S. Embassy when the U.S. Embassy wouldn't play ball with his demands, and that's why you saw Masha Yovanovitch fired. I think he was frustrated with other U.S. government officials facilitating access, frustration with not being able to facilitate the president's ambitions. So he turned to these shady characters who just happened to speak Ukrainian and have worked with Giuliani in the past to find ways to get access and information. And as a result, I think these characters had their own interests, but also the question is, who was backing them? And a lot of this goes back to an individual, Dmytro Firtash, who's a Ukrainian who has run significant Russian-Ukrainian energy deals and alleged funneled money to President Trump through these individuals as a way to get into the administration's own good graces and prevent his own extradition to the United States, where he's wanted on several charges.
Very interesting and complicated. But as we close, P.J. Crowley, we will see how the impeachment inquiry plays out, but the Republicans have actually tried to disparage the inquiry. And I guess also the denigration of Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman, the top Ukraine official on the National Security Council. He is a refugee from Ukraine. He's a patriot. He became a veteran. We heard some people disparaging him. How do you see the Republican response? Is it tenable going forward?
It's a split screen. The accusations that he's a double agent are abhorrent. I am encouraged that some Republicans and Democrats as well have come to Colonel Vindman's defense, saying this is going, you know, way too far. Obviously, the impeachment inquiry is unfolding in the context of partisan politics in the United States. I think I would just bring people back to a bigger picture, that this is representative of the tragedy of the Trump administration, the president's inability to process what happened in 2016, his concern that Russian interference somehow
undermines
the legitimacy of his election. He could very easily have said, look, it's impossible to know what the impact was, but clearly Russia attacked us, and he could have made election security and Russian accountability pillars of his foreign policy. That's not the course he chose. He chose, as we saw in Helsinki, to back Putin over his intelligence community. And what's happened with Ukraine is just another representation of this blind spot that he seems to have towards Russia, where he just can't see not only the reality of what Russia has done, but the practical limitations of our ability to cooperate with Russia going forward.
And on that note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Mark Simakovsky, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, and P.J. Crowley, former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guests. Our engineer was Wojtek Zorniak.
I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another encounter on The Voice of America.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Kelly Jean Kelly, Brian Lynn, and Steve Ember. But first, this report from Jonathan Evans.
Students around the world wanting help with the TOEFL English test have a new tool, a mobile app. The TOEFL official app became available last week. Users can download it from the Apple App Store or Google Play. TOEFL stands for Test of English as a Foreign Language. Students must pass the test to get into many universities in the United States and other English-speaking countries. It is made up of four parts: reading, listening, writing, and speaking. Test takers will be able to use it for everything from registration and test preparation to receiving their scores and requesting health-related accommodations. What we wanted to do through the app is to meet them where they are on their own terms and schedule and on the devices they increasingly prefer to use, said Srikant Gopal. He leads the TOEFL program at the Nonprofit Educational Testing Service, or ETS. After downloading the app, users can get material to help prepare them for the test. They can also register to take the test. And, the organization says, users can see their test scores and send reports to schools they wish to attend. Students also can search for the test centers near where they are, as well as find open seats for the test. This works through Google Maps. The app will be available everywhere in the world, except China. Gopal said that TOEFL has a very different registration system and a very different kind of arrangement with the Chinese authorities. Companies in China must go through the Chinese National Education Examinations Authority. TOEFL has not decided yet whether it will work on such an app for China. The TOEFL program has also introduced several test-based changes in recent months. It has been cut from 3.5 hours long to 3 hours long. The new, shorter test started in August. TOEFL has reduced the number of questions in 3 of 4 parts of the test. The same language skills will be tested, and scoring stays the same as well. The test preparation materials will be changed over the next several months, but all the existing official materials can still be used because the test content has not changed. The reading section now includes 3 to 4 passages with 10 questions each. The section takes 54 to 72 minutes. The listening section now has 3 to 4 lectures with 6 questions each, as well as 2 to 3 conversations with 5 questions each. The section takes 41 to 57 minutes. The speaking section now has 4 questions instead of 6. The section takes a total of 17 minutes. The writing section remains unchanged. It has 2 essay questions, which take a total of 50 minutes. Also, the 10-minute break between the listening and speaking parts of the test remains the same. Test takers will now be able to get their scores more quickly. Students taking the test after October 26 can get their scores online in 6 days instead of 10. The official score report will now also be sent to colleges and universities as early as 9 days after the test date. Another recent change is the so-called My Best Scores. The company permits test takers to use the highest scores they have achieved on each part of the test. The scores must be from tests taken within the last 2 years. Students can use the app to send these My Best reports to universities. The My Best score shows not just the student's performance in one single test, but their potential over time, Gopal said. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. On this show, we explore words and expressions in the English language. We can also tell where they come from. And probably more importantly, for those learning to speak English, we explain how and when we use these terms. Reading is a popular activity for people all over the world. There is nothing quite like getting lost in a really good book. It can be a special experience. Minor problems melt away as the characters in the story seem to come to life. The best part about books is that they can take you anywhere you want. They can take you to places that do not even exist. We can also understand the world around us and its people better by reading stories. So it is no surprise that Americans sometimes use expressions involving the word book. Today, we will talk about 2 such terms. Both use the 2 main verbs you need when talking about a book, reading and writing. Let us begin with an expression from a reader's point of view. The following example sounds like an enjoyable activity, reading someone like a book. Yet to read someone like a book means that you know the person very well, and usually not in a good way. We often use this expression in special situations. A person may be trying to trick you, but you know their true objectives. In other words, you can see through their attempts to fool you or someone else. Now, let's hear how this expression is used in this exchange between 2 coworkers.
Were you able to get him to agree to the deal?
No, he didn't sign the agreement.
Without his signature, we cannot make the movie.
Don't you think I know that? I thought it was a sure thing. He said he was really interested. So I took him to dinner. I spent a lot of money on a bottle of wine. I even offered him front row seats to that sold-out show next weekend.
And he still didn't sign.
If you ask me, he had no interest in signing the contract. He just wanted a free dinner and more.
Yes, he read you like a book.
So that is an expression with the verb read. Now, let's turn to one with the words to write. When you become an expert at something, you may write a book about it. After all, many experts write about what they know. They want to share their expertise, or make a name for themselves, or both. In any case, we use the expression to write the book on something to describe a person who knows a lot about something. And this person does not need to have published an actual book, but it can be funny to tie the two together, like in the following example.
What's keeping you so busy these days? I haven't seen you in weeks.
I am studying for my exams on building materials, but I'm having a lot of trouble. I'm not sure what materials are the best or worst for natural disasters.
You should talk to Madeline.
Madeline? Is she good with building homes in disaster areas?
Are you serious? She is the leading expert on building for natural disasters, from earthquakes to hurricanes.
I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. She wrote the book on the subject, literally and figuratively. In fact, do you want to borrow her book? I have a copy.
Yes, and please give her my number. I would love to pick her brain.
And that's all for Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Kelly Jean Kelly for Ana Mateo.
Weather experts say Taiwan and the Philippines have experienced fewer typhoons in recent years. The reduced storm activity may be the result of higher water temperatures and changes in upper atmosphere winds. Taiwan, which sits in the western Pacific, normally gets hit hard by 3 to 4 typhoons each year between the months of June and October. Each storm can kill 5 to 10 people and can cause major damage. Taiwan's neighbor to the south, the Philippines, can get up to 20 typhoons per year. The storms bring winds strong enough to blow down trees and rainfall that can quickly turn streets into rivers. They usually cause mass evacuations and widespread transportation problems. The systems are called cyclones and hurricanes in other parts of the world. For the past 3 years, Taiwan and the Philippines have missed their historical average typhoon counts. Weather officials say one of the main reasons for this is higher water temperatures in the mid-Pacific, where such storms form. In addition, wind directions have changed in the upper atmosphere and are blowing more typhoons to the north. Jason Nichols is an international weather expert with U.S.-based forecasting company AccuWeather. Nichols told VOA that weather officials have seen a general warming of waters in the Indian Ocean and in the Pacific in recent years. Nichols added that ocean temperatures in the central and eastern Pacific Ocean have been warming up since 2017. He said this caused typhoons to form in areas to the north and east of Taiwan and the Philippines. Upper atmosphere winds pushed the storms north. Most of this year's 21 typhoons in Asia moved north to reach Japan, South Korea, and China. The most severe, Typhoon Hagibis, killed 80 people in eastern Japan earlier this month. Western Pacific waters have been somewhat cooler this year, Nichols said. This means fewer storms have formed near the eastern coasts of Taiwan or the Philippines. Asia's deadliest storms each year often reach the Philippines, including 2013's super typhoon that killed 6,340 people. So far this year, no major typhoons have hit the country. It has experienced weaker tropical storms, however. I'm Brian Lin.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. During the first half of the 19th century, leaders of the United States could find no answer to the question of slavery. The dispute grew more threatening after the war with Mexico in 1849. Northern states refused to permit slavery in the new territories of California and New Mexico. Southern states declared that they had a constitutional right to bring slaves into the new lands. The South was ready to secede, to leave, and break up the Union of States. Then, in 1850, Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky offered a compromise to avoid secession and a likely war between the North and South. He said the Union was permanent and created for all future Americans. He attacked the South's claim that it had the right to leave. He warned the war that would follow Southern secession would be long and bloody. 1 week after Senator Clay spoke, Senator Jefferson Davis of Mississippi explained his position. He did not say much about Clay's proposed compromise. Davis was sure that no good would result from it, not even from stronger laws on the return of escaped slaves. Davis said what was needed was a change in the North's policy toward the South. He said the North must recognize the rights of Southerners, especially the right to take slave property into U.S. territories. Davis said Congress had no right to destroy or limit this right. He admitted that the old Missouri Compromise of 1820 had limited the right to take slaves into the territories. He said the 1820 Compromise worked not because Congress passed it, but because the states agreed to it. Senator Davis said the North was responsible for the growing split in the country because the North was trying to get complete control of the South. He said if these efforts were not stopped, the North someday would be powerful enough to change the Constitution and end slavery everywhere. Davis warned the South would never accept this change. 3 weeks later, the Senate heard another Southern leader, Senator John C. Calhoun of South Carolina. For years, Calhoun was the voice of the South. He now was 68 years old and a sick man. He spent the last week in February writing what he believed to be the true position of the South. Many senators understood it would be his last speech. On Monday, March 4th, the Senate was crowded when Calhoun entered. One by one, friends came to speak to him. The old man's long, gray hair fell to his shoulders. His face was thin and white, but his eyes were bright and his jaw firm. Calhoun was too weak to read his speech. He asked another senator to read it for him. Calhoun said that for a long time he had believed the dispute over slavery, if not settled, would end in disunion. Calhoun said it was clear now to everyone that the Union was breaking apart, that the ties that had held the North and South together were breaking one by one. Three churches, once united across the nation, now were split between the North and South. The major political parties, he declared, were divided in the same way. Calhoun said the North was responsible for all this disunity because it had destroyed the political balance between the two parts of the country. As the population of the North had grown large, he noted, that part of the country seized political and economic control. The North passed tariff bills the South opposed. It had filled most of the offices in the federal government. It closed the new territories to Southern slaveholders. And, said Calhoun, it viciously attacked the Southern institution of slavery. The situation was so bad, he said, that the South could not, with honor and safety, remain in the Union. How can the Union be saved, he asked. Not by the compromise proposed by the senator from Kentucky. There is but one way, a full and final settlement with justice of all the questions disputed by the two sections. The South asks for justice, simple justice, and less she ought not to take. She has no compromise to offer but the Constitution, and no concession or surrender to make. She has already surrendered so much that she has little left to surrender. At the end of Calhoun's speech to the Senate, Southern lawmakers crowded around the old man, congratulating him. But many of them could not agree with his demands and the violence of his words. By now, most Southerners believed that Senator Clay's proposals were a reasonable way to settle the difference and protect the Union. Yet, Clay worried that Northerners might reject his proposals. Many in the North felt slavery was wrong. They opposed Clay's compromise because it might permit slavery in New Mexico and because it called for stronger laws on the return of slaves who had escaped to the North. So Clay asked an important senator from the North to speak in support of his proposals. Daniel Webster represented the northeastern state of Massachusetts. Senator Webster believed that slavery was evil. Yet he believed that national unity was more important. He did not want the nation to divide. He did not want to see the end of the United States of America. Webster was 68 years old as Calhoun. 3 days after Calhoun's speech, Webster spoke to the Senate. His voice was weaker now, but his words rang with the same strength as years earlier. I speak today, he said, to save the Union. I speak today out of a concerned and troubled heart. I speak for the return of a spirit of unity. I speak for the return of that general feeling of agreement which makes the blessings of this union so special to us all. Senator Webster spoke of how he hated slavery. He spoke of his fight against the spread of slavery, but he disagreed with those who wanted laws making slavery illegal in new territories. It would not be wise to pass such laws, he said. They would only make the South angry. They would only push the South away from the Union. Then Webster spoke about the things the North and South had done to make each other angry. One, he said, was the failure of the North to return runaway slaves. He said the South had good reason to protest. It was a matter of law. The law was contained in Article 4 of the nation's Constitution. Every member of every Northern legislature, Webster said, has sworn to support the Constitution of the United States. And the Constitution says that states must return runaway slaves to their owners. This part of the Constitution has as much power as any other part. It must be obeyed. Next, Webster spoke about abolition societies. These were organizations that demanded an end to slavery everywhere in the country. I do not think that abolition societies are useful, Webster said. At the same time, I believe that thousands of their members are honest and good citizens who feel they must do something for liberty. However, their interference with the South has produced trouble. As an example, Webster spoke about the state of Virginia. Slavery was legal there. Webster noted that public opinion in Virginia had been turning against slavery until abolitionists angered the people. After that, he said, no one would talk openly against slavery. He said abolitionists were not ending slavery, but helping it continue. Then Webster said the North also had a right to protest about some things the South had done. He said the South was wrong to take slaves into new American territories. He said attempts to expand slavery violated earlier agreements to limit slavery to areas where it already existed. Webster said the North also had a right to protest statements by Southern leaders about working conditions in the North. Southerners often said that slaves in the South lived better lives than free workers in the North. Webster appealed to both sides to forgive each other. He urged them to come to an agreement. He said the South could never leave the Union without violence. Webster said the two sides were joined together socially, economically, culturally, and in many other ways. There was no way to divide them. No Congress, he said, could establish a border between the North and South that either side would accept. In general, Webster's speech to the Senate was moderate. He wanted to appeal to reason, not emotion. Yet it was difficult for him to be unemotional. His voice rose as he finished. Secession, he called out. Peaceable secession. Your eyes and mine will never see that happen. There can be no such thing as peaceable secession. We live under a great constitution. Is it to be melted away by secession, as the snows of a mountain are melted away under the sun? Let us not speak of the possibility of secession. Let us not debate an idea so full of horror. Let us not live with the thought of such darkness. Instead, let us come out into the light of day. Let us enjoy the fresh air of liberty and union. Northern abolitionists quickly criticized Daniel Webster's speech. They called him a traitor. But most people of the North accepted Webster's appeal for compromise. His speech cooled the debate that threatened a complete break between the North and South. Yet the speech was not the end of the debate.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.